And good afternoon. It is a Thursday, November the 15th, 2018, 17 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program, and you are tuned in on a great day, because there are three things going on in the world right now that are on my mind. Number one, the midterm elections, and things going on with our current president that have just ended. HBO saying there's going to be no more boxing in 2019. Can you believe that? That's hard to believe. And the holidays, which are very fast approaching. Now, when you're talking about holidays, you're talking about elections, and you're talking about HBO, there's only one man who fits the bill for all three of those cases. He is a many-time visitor to this program, and we are always happy when he stops by. It's like having a relative stop by as we're in the swing of things here in the holiday season. What a pleasure it is to welcome the greatest boxing analyst there ever was, is, or will be. HBO, we miss him terribly, Larry Merchant. Larry, how are you?
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for that lavish introduction. And here I am in somewhat still smoky Santa Monica. The fires missed us, stopping up in Malibu a few miles down the road. But as you deal with the cold and the snow, this is one of our unfortunate weather systems.
Larry, it's interesting because we here in the Midwest, and I think outside of California, this has become a national story, but I don't think we really understand what is happening. What is going on in California?
Well, I certainly don't have all the answers, but from what I've been reading and watching, apparently some remote areas have been populated by people who just sort of want to get off the grid and get away from the big cities where things are so expensive and so on. And secondly, they believe that climate change with unusually hot weather has contributed. You know, at the same time as we've had these fires that seem to last for weeks, in a place like Texas, they've had prairie fires and 100 degree weather for longer than ever. Whether that's just some new thing or some old thing seems irrelevant, because we're all seeing it through the lens of change.
It's very interesting, to be sure. Want to switch to HBO. After this year, HBO vice president, 37-year-old vice president, has announced that HBO will be out of the boxing business. And my understanding, as I read the New York Times article from late September, is that it's not driving subscriptions anymore, and everybody involved in the boxing program will be let go except Jim Lampley, who will stay on with HBO, is my understanding. 45 years in that business. What do you think happened, Larry?
Well, first of all, regarding Jim, he had the prescience to get a long-term contract. So I don't know what exactly will become of him, whether he'll skip over to one of the new platforms or not. Well, what happened here was that HBO found that big live events, particularly of marquee names like Sugar Ray Leonard and Tommy Hearns and Marvin Hagler, and then the heavyweights George Foreman and Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield, and then as the Titanic plates shifted toward the Southwest, because Mexican and Mexican Americans had such a passion for the sport, their stars came on HBO, and it became a kind of loss leader. The ratings didn't matter, but the marketing enabled HBO to get a real foothold in the television world and to show its groundbreaking stuff against the old networks, ABC, CBS, NBC. And it became a huge thing. And I actually didn't fully understand it until I was in New York visiting some friends and relatives a couple of months ago when the announcement was made. And I was sitting in a place called Washington Square, or no, Union Square, and when I got a call from a reporter telling me about this announcement, it was not unexpected, given the drift of boxing shows that were being put on, and also the fact that HBO was investing a fraction of the money that it used to into marketing and acquiring events, and also knowing that the top people at HBO no longer had a kind of corporate memory of what boxing had done for it, and also that HBO suddenly found that its real opponents anymore weren't the old networks. Obviously, it was Netflix and Amazon Prime and the new world of social media. And you put all those things together, and everybody just said, well, we had a good show for 45 years. Not many shows last for that long. But it surprised me that so many people were struck, because it had become a destination for people who weren't even boxing fans, who had understood that there was this tradition, and that there was some kind of popular cultural meaning to all of this and excitement. And it struck me since then how many people have felt, well, there's a void in their lives almost. And I, having left HBO a few years ago, felt a bit of a body blow when I heard it. But all of these things became the dots out in the universe that were connected. And HBO, at the same time, they are part of the Warner Brothers, and they combined with AT&T, and they're looking into a brave new world of digital and other forms of communication. So life goes on. Interestingly, really interestingly, suddenly there are more platforms, including Fox, now Showtime and ESPN, that are putting more money into boxing than ever. And that includes a British company that's putting on international fights that collected well over $1 billion in investments, and they're paying fighters extravagant amounts of money to start off their version of what HBO was half a century ago.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Larry, because I look at HBO, and 1978, boxing comes on the air, and I think one of the reasons that I think it did drive subscription services in those days was, of course, you've got to have good fights, and they did, but they had colorful characters. As Howard Cosell was leaving boxing on ABC, as that range was disappearing, HBO had you, Harold Letterman, very colorful, Jim Lampley, George Foreman, at one point was a regular commentator. They did things that other people didn't do.
Well, I had never thought of this, but other people I know in the business, the show business, felt that the edginess with which we approached boxing, rather than as a show we owned and therefore always had to cheerlead and put our best foot forward and rationalize why fights weren't as good as they were supposed to be, there was an edginess in our boxing coverage, and there was an edginess in other things that HBO was doing back in that day that nobody else was doing. They were doing comedic and music shows that you couldn't show on regular network television, and then they expanded into movies that were edgy and four-letter wordy, etc. So there was a moment there that the public was ready for and enticed by that caught fire.
When you came to HBO in 1978, and it was your first event on HBO television, boxing, what did they tell you they wanted you to do?
Well, I was there as a commentator. I was the first guy that their executive producer hired. And I had been a columnist in New York for 10 years. Previous to that, I worked in Philadelphia for many years as an editor and columnist. And they never said to me what they wanted. They hired what they wanted. And that was just to, ultimately, as they were told by a person they hired to help all of their announcers, he told them to just leave me alone. So we were just making it up as we went along, and it was sometimes difficult, because as my boss Seth Abraham said to me, "You make my job more difficult," meaning he used to hear from fighters, promoters, everybody he had to deal with and negotiate with, about something I or someone else might have said that wasn't as salutary as they were expecting as contract employees of HBO. And he said to me, "You're not making my job easier, but keep doing what you're doing." So they knew what they were doing. And it wasn't that we were looking for controversy. From my point of view, I had been a, quote, journalist for a long time. And I did what I thought any journalist did. You give credit where it's deserved, but you're not afraid to be critical where you felt it was necessary. And but that was an unusual thing to do on television at the time. And at the same time, I saw my job as creating a narrative of the fights, showing who these athletes were as human beings, as well as athletes, revealing some of the inside stories of the colorful culprits and characters that surrounded the sport. And that's how I saw us as a show, not just as an event, and that I was looking for ways to show it was entertainment, it was serious, and here's the story of what's happening and what happened tonight.
When you left HBO in 2012, they did a video package of some of your great moments, and so many of those surrounded the in-ring interviews at the end of the fights. When you were perched, wherever you were perched, before the fight ended, and not knowing who's going to win, how did you approach those? What were you thinking when you went in? And sometimes you were not always nice in those interviews, which up until that point, most people had been, broadcasters.
Well, again, I had done a million and a half interviews before I went on television. And what I found was you had a compressed amount of time, a few minutes, and that you had to get to the story of what you thought this fight was about, how it affected the characters on the scene, what was going on, why it did or didn't work, and so on. I was doing what any journalist would do a half hour later at a press conference, except I was doing it a minute later. And that said, in trying to tell the story, I've always felt that the best interview that I ever did was with a guy from right there in Ohio, in your neighborhood, with Buster Douglas after he beat Mike Tyson. And Buster Douglas's mom had died a few weeks before. He came running into the ring, which was unusual for anybody about to fight Tyson. He fought masterfully. He pulled off one of the great upsets in sports history. And he was so emotionally overwrought after the fight, presumably because of his mom, and also some of the issues he had with his dad all of his life, his dad having been a fighter himself. He couldn't talk. And it might have been 20 seconds, it might have been a half a minute, that he couldn't gather himself. And the people around him were urging him to go back to the dressing room and just to relax, and no, he wanted to stay. And I stood there with the mic in his face and heard a voice in my head say, "This is show and tell. That's what television and a live event is. You're showing something and then you're telling about it. And if the fight and the event and the itself is telling the story, get out of the way." But in this case, I just held the mic until he could gather himself. And in that 20 or 30 seconds, which seems like hours on television where everybody is chattering all the time, it told the story that he wanted to tell and that he finally got to tell about him and his mother and his feelings. And that's a rare bit of live television without a lot of live syllables crackling across the air.
We look back at 45 years of HBO, and we certainly have to say that was a great moment. You were there. At what point during that fight did you realize something is going differently here?
Well, along around the second round, it seemed and actually was the case that Douglas was hitting Tyson more than we had ever seen him get hit. and that he, being a taller fighter who had boxing skills, but in much of the time he was in the ring, his defensive skill was to hit Tyson first, which is what the best professional prize fighters do. And you couldn't take it yet seriously. We all have ideas of what might happen, what was supposed to happen. But we did all comment on the fact that this was something new, that Buster Douglas was following a blueprint for how to beat a fighter of Tyson's stature and type. Could he actually follow it through the end? What would happen when he got hit? Those things we didn't know. What we did know was that he had a plan, and that he was working the plan, and it was working.
Yeah, there are a lot of great moments. I'm rambling through them in my head. Buster Douglas, certainly. The time you pushed the fan, I think he was a fan, out of the way during the fight.
I was a fan, and we were in Boston, and there was a controversial decision. And I think it might have been an assistant trainer or somebody who jumped into the ring and was very angry, and as I was interviewing the winner, this fellow wanted the world to know that he thought it was a bad, terrible decision. And I gave him what we used to call in football a forearm shiver.
Yeah, we all remember that. And then, of course, how could we forget Floyd Mayweather? And I'll never forget. Now, this will tell you what kind of guy Larry Merchant is. I want to tell this story. I don't know if I've ever told this on air. You know, here I'm doing a radio show in Ohio, and it was the biggest story on the face of God's green earth when Larry Merchant got into it with Floyd Mayweather on a Saturday night. And I called Larry the next day. I believe it was Sunday. And you were at an airport, and you gave me an interview when everybody else was calling. And I'll never forget that. That's Larry Merchant for you. But Larry, what about that moment?
Well, that was a spontaneous moment in which I was counterpunching a fighter, a champion, who was attacking me personally, because the crowd was in such an ugly mood and booing him as the interview went on. And I guess I was a stand-in for the whole crowd. He had beaten Victor Ortiz on what I described as a legal sucker punch. All the fans saw was a sucker punch with... There was some controversy going on in the middle of the ring, and the referee had gone off to the side to talk to a commissioner or one of the judges. And while Ortiz watched the official, the referee, go off to the side with his arms at his side, Mayweather clocked him, knocked him down, and it was essentially the end of the fight. And the fans all saw this and thought, what's going on here? And so they became extremely volatile, and I was the guy that was talking to Mayweather, and so he suddenly went after me in some personal way, which had nothing to do with the interview that I hadn't even gotten to that moment yet. But he knew what was going on, and that volatile crowd that was turning on him made him know that he wasn't going to get full credit for what he had just done. And I said what I said, and I'm not smart enough to have planned that.
The other moment that sticks out in my mind when we're recounting this 45 years on HBO, it wasn't such a pressured moment, but when your broadcast colleague, George Foreman, wins on HBO, becomes the oldest heavyweight fighter, world champion, you go in to do the interview. What do you remember from that moment?
You know, I don't remember what I remember. I remember the fight. I don't remember the interview. What impressed me so much about what George Foreman had done, and Foreman had the most complete personality change I had ever seen in a human being, much less in an athlete. And the 10 years between his earlier career and when he came back to boxing, in what seemed like a lark, not serious. And he took a terrible beating in the fight from Michael Moore in the first half of the fight. And what I remember remarking was something that Foreman had said to me one time about heavyweight champions in particular, how the first thing you want to know is, can they take it? And that Foreman had pulled off that late knockout because he was willing to walk through the fire, even at his age, and still come out standing to where he could land a knockout punch late in the fight. And I had a lot of fun with George as co-commentators, because I came to the fight from one perspective as a journalist. He came at it from another perspective as a fighter, and we had our moments in which I found myself often thinking, I'm not the star of this show. The fighters are the star of this show. Get out of the way. But we kept jabbing away at each other and having fun, and apparently that became a thing. And also unusual for that time, or maybe any time, that the commentators would have such disagreements, sometimes strong disagreements.
Larry, as we have said, you were with HBO Boxing 1978 until 2012. When did the relationship change? Because I remember when you retired, you did go back and do some work with George Foreman. You did some commercials, which were very fun and entertaining.
I did international. I covered international fights for Top Rank and wound up going to China 6 times in a year and a half and so on. And I very much enjoyed that part of my career. What changed? Things change. I got old. Maybe they wanted somebody who looked and was younger, or maybe they just got tired of my act, or they thought that the dwindling ratings could be revived in some way. I think one of the things that happened that contributed to the long, slow decline of HBO was the fact that from that time in the late 80s and early 90s, the time of Foreman and Holyfield and Lennox Lewis and Tyson and Riddick Bowe, a great era of heavyweights, for a quarter of a century, almost to this day, there hasn't been an elite American heavyweight. A lot of people followed boxing who were not sports fans, much less boxing fans, because the heavyweight championship of the world was such a big deal. I mean, you're looking at a guy who, under the rules, the Queensberry rules, could beat any human being on the planet. And suddenly all of our heavyweights were playing linebacker someplace or power forward. And that vacuum contributed, I think, to the decline of ratings and such. And me, I had 35 great years, and I had no complaints that when they had a new executive producer, he wanted to put his own imprint. I'll tell you a story I haven't told very often. They were at the time negotiating a contract with Mayweather that I think was gonna either was about or was about to lead to the Pacquiao fight, which generated an enormous amount of revenues of north of $600 million. But in any event, when he came in, this new executive, we sat down and we had a chat, and he said, you think you could just take it a little easier on Mayweather? This could hurt us. We could lose millions of dollars. And I said to him two things. One of them is my experience was that when an athlete is unhappy with whether the crowd or the writers or the announcers are falling out of love with him, even if it's just for a minute, that they only want more. It never stops. And then secondly, I said to him, look, I said, I don't know how to bunt. I play in the middle of the lineup. And in any event, about a year later, I had a few other problems with him. He wasn't aware of the tradition that I mentioned earlier where they said, you're giving us problems, but keep doing it. I just told myself, I don't want to feel anymore that I'm slapping my daddy around. And we were in El Paso for a fight, and there was a crazy story in which they were afraid of the fight because of the drug gangs from across the river in Juarez and in El Paso, and they had decided that they weren't going to sell any beer, and they made other arrangements. And I was told that I'm not supposed to mention this. And of course I mentioned it because it was such a weird story. And afterwards I went to them and said, you know, let's work out the end of my contract. I don't want to do this anymore. And they weren't going to rehire me anyway. So it worked out for both of us. And especially it worked out for me because many months after I left, the negotiation with Mayweather fell through anyway. So they couldn't blame it on me. Mm. I was gone already.
The last night with HBO in 2012, they did a retrospective of your career. What was the last night like with the crew and with Jim?
Well, this is another case of my having to defy them. The new group. The afternoon of that fight, I get a call from a high-up executive at HBO, not in the sports department. And it was one of these corporate things in which he was saying to me, you know, we ought to talk after this is over and see what we can work out for each other, implying that if I went out peacefully, that they would look to do something with me. I understood from previous experience that this was total BS. They were just trying to hope that I didn't say anything that would be embarrassing to them on the air on the air that night, which I had no intention of doing. When you work at a place for 35 years and it's over, nobody is going to have sympathy if you go out crying. And originally they wanted me to go on air well after the fight happened, because they wanted to minimize any chance that there'd be some backlash. And the information was acquired, put it that way, the day before the fight, by some reporter who called me while I was in the airport going to a fight, and to that fight, which I think was in Houston. And so it became common information that this was going to be my last event. And they were literally afraid that I might try to humiliate somebody. And I had a meeting with myself and said, you know what, this all good things come to an end. And I thanked a bunch of people. And I was quite all right, because it was time. You don't always pick the time yourself, but it was time, and I was going to go out on the highest note that I could, and I felt perfectly okay about it.
Today, Larry, of course people recognize you with boxing, I think, more than the other sports, but you were a sports journalist. If somebody called today and said, I want you to come commentate, analyze, broadcast a baseball game, a football game, a boxing match, one-time shot, would you do it?
Probably, yeah. I know I was I was steeped in football as a young guy. And I was a backfield coach in high school, my old high school, for 3 seasons before I decided that was not the path I wanted to follow. And I always thought I could do what I did in boxing in football. But I never got the chance, and that's okay too. And my first original love in sports was and still is baseball. So yeah, I'd love to have some fun with that, but I'm not waiting for it to happen.
Larry, one of the great things is we're talking about HBO and remembering their 45 years in boxing, which you were certainly a big part of. I remember the show you did, it reminded me of Larry King's show, where you'd have the fighters on and interview them. And the one I remember the most, of course, is Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson. Did you like doing the straight studio interview show?
Yes, I did. You know, it was, to me, it was part of any event is the lead up to the event and the follow up to the event. What I remember best about the Douglas Tyson fight was while I was on a plane coming back home, that the corrupt WBC had overturned the knockout, was making an attempt to tell us all that what we saw we didn't see, because of Don King and Tyson being such a valuable commodity to the sport at that time. And we did an interview show, and it was very straightforward with, I knew Tyson was not the instigator of this, that it was all about Don King. And I was very tough on Tyson. And Buster was there, and interestingly enough, he was very laid back about the whole thing. Here they were trying to steal the heavyweight championship of the world from him. And he didn't want to be inflammatory at that point. It later went to arbitration, in which I was a witness, and told the arbitrators that what they were trying to do here was to win something outside the ring that they had lost in the ring. Well, these kinds of stories that I'm telling you and are part of the story of the fight to me. Maybe not to the public that just remembers this unimaginable moment, and rightly so, the fight is the thing. But if you're a storyteller and a journalist and so on, all of it is of a part of the story.
Absolutely. It's interesting. This is a superficial thing, but I was curious about it. I was looking at some pictures of your days at HBO on the internet this afternoon, and for most of your career there, you wore a tuxedo. Was that Larry Merchant's choice, or was that an HBO thing?
No, it was an HBO thing. The wearing of tuxedos at boxing events had a history. Going way back when so-called gentlemen would come together in a ballroom someplace, everybody, not just announcers, wearing tuxedos to watch a prize fight. So we went along with that, and then suddenly everybody, not everybody, but the producers felt that this was no longer a thing, and a jacket and a tie was the thing.
What do you miss most, and what will you miss most about boxing and HBO, that combination?
Well, it's a visceral thing, Scott. When I was sitting in the park in New York and heard from the reporter who told me about the statement about the end of HBO boxing, I felt that it was a body blow. I had no idea when it would happen. Everyone in the sport knew it was going to happen sooner or later. But when it happened, it was a body blow. And that it was a part of my life. I tried to do my homework, tried to do the best I could do for a long time, and when I started getting a lot of calls, I sat down and wrote a little piece that a friend of mine who was a publicist in the sport sent out to all the media around, and it went something like this. Once upon a time, We were a promising kid, then a contender, then a champion, a major champion, a long-time champion, and then an old champion, and then retired. So long, champ.
Well, we will say goodbye to HBO, but we're certainly not going to say goodbye to Larry Merchant. And had there not been Larry Merchant on HBO, as your former boss, I think, knew very well, there would not have been 45 years on HBO of boxing, because you are part of the soundtrack of so many great moments in boxing history. And I'm always honored when you come on this program, which I hope you will continue to do like a family member at holiday time. Larry, you are the best.
Scott, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Stay well.
As well. Back at you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. The one and only Larry Merchant. We're coming back in 10 minutes. Terry Tackett and Trivia. Hey, there you go. Stay tuned.
The WWGH Radio prize policy is as follows. You have 10